who can turn the world on with her smile? Who can take a nothing day and suddenly make it all seem worthwhile? Well, it's you, girl, and you should know it. With each glance and every little movement you show it, love is all around, no need to waste it. You can have the town, why don't you take it? You're gonna make it after all.
This may turn out to be a pretty fair party after all.
Fair, Mr. Grant?
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be the best party that you have. What's happening to the lights?
I don't know. I think they're starting to dim.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I think that's true. But my view is I see things from almost from a third world point of view, what we used to call the third world. I was actually in Kabul when he was elected. And I was in the basement of the Gandamak Lodge, which is this old sort of British Raj era, strange place, sort of like a British pub underneath the lodge itself, with a couple of hundred lovely, beautiful Americans, all shapes and colors and sizes, not just NGO people and aid people and advisors, but a lot of military people too. At the time, Kabul was the Afghanistan had the largest contingent of Americans abroad, Democrats abroad, and the largest component of the Obama voters within Democrats abroad. And people were weeping and so happy, so full of hope and optimism, you know, because he was the guy who said, well, you know, Afghanistan's going to be the serious war. We kind of screwed up in Iraq. I'm the guy who's going to take Afghanistan seriously. And then within months, you know, what became evident is that as soon as he stepped into the Oval Office, the first question he asked is, how do we get out of Afghanistan? And, you know, you started to see the implications of his rapprochement with the Ayatollahs quite rapidly taking force and effect in Afghanistan. Within about 6 months, there were 30,000, I think it was 30,000 employees, salaried employees of what was called the, and what is called the Imam Khomeini relief organization in Afghanistan. And you know, when I the people on the left that I identify with and associate with are, they tend to be Iranians, Syrians, Afghans, Hong Kongers, Taiwanese, and it is a completely different perspective than what one might attribute to, you know, the liberal left in America land, you know. It's not a flattering portrait that emerges of Obama. Yeah, yeah. Canada as well, of course. And this is something that I did a piece for Maclean's last week on this subject, you know, the sort of everybody in Canada getting excited about the resistance, as it's calling itself, and the Women's March on Washington. I have to say I find it a little bit embarrassing, maybe the tiniest bit pathetic. I mean, I get it, and I'm with these people, and fair play to them, but... you know, we kind of, you know, it's like a cargo cult thing. We're not Americans. And, you know, if we want to figure out, you know, what's the progressive, you know, effective internationalist position to take on questions like Syria, Libya, Egypt, Afghanistan, Iran, China, Southeast Asia, Central Asia, Russia. I don't know why we have to turn to fat liars like Michael Moore to figure out what to think. Oh, I think there is actually. I think it was. I think it appeared in either the Senate or the House of Representatives today. There was a Republican bill to withdraw from the United Nations. I think that's crazy. I think it's just crazy people. You know, I've been very critical of the United Nations. Mainly, I think I've been very critical of this strange kind of disco generation adulation of the United Nations. You know. This really weird, you know, we ran on it. I mean, the liberals ran on it, you know, like, oh, Canada's back and we're going to, you know, multilateralism, we're going to go to the UN and everybody likes us. And I mean, man, disco's dead, for God's sake. Where are these people been? You know? And here it is a year later. I mean, you know, the wreckage is, you know, the light, there's a really harsh and grim light, I think, that is has sort of illuminated the wreckage that occurred primarily during the Obama administration. The retreat of democracy the world round, the rise of strongman government, the abandonment by the Americans of any leadership in NATO, the red line that was crossed in Syria, becoming, demonstrating to every tyrant around the world that you can wage war on your own people, you can use chlorine gas, you can use mustard gas, you can use barrel bombs, you can pretty well do anything that you want, and no one's going to mess with you. You can get away with it, because if the largest and most powerful and ambitious power within NATO is going to say, oh, well, we'll let the Russians take care of it, that sends a pretty strong signal to everybody. And that's what we've seen, I think, throughout the course of the Obama years. If you look at all of the major sort of signifiers of democratic development, Freedom House does a very good job of this. But they're not alone in this, but their data is actually quite sound on freedom of speech, on democratic elections, civil rights, women's rights, freedom of assembly, and crucially, freedom of speech and press rights, press freedom. All the indicators have gone into reverse over the last 10 years, and we're back at a place pretty close to before the Soviet Union collapsed. Certainly, it's more dire than anything we've seen in a quarter of a century. Well, I think there's a couple of things here. In the same way that we have to sort of take this view, I think, when we're looking at the election that just produced this monstrous gargoyle, Donald Trump. There's a couple of things going on. The first is the campaign itself. Was it sensible to have defenestrated Bernie Sanders, who I quite like, although I think he's an idiot on foreign policy, but never mind. Was Hillary Clinton really the candidate that the Democrats should have gone with? Was it sensible to have ignored, the necessity of working the streets in those swing states like Wisconsin and so on? I mean, that's all very interesting. But there's also this other sort of broader cultural issue where I think, what we call the left, or what calls itself the left in America, has proved itself useless and silly and reactionary. Absolutely just a joke. And the universities, I think, are just, just this sort of wasteland. There's no intellectual leadership at all. And so there's those two things, kind of like a Venn diagram, right? And then when you look at Obama, I think similarly, there was a culture that produced Obama. And it wasn't just an American culture. It was largely a Euro-American white liberal elite culture that went a little bit deranged, I think, in its affections and excitement about Barack Obama. The Nobel Peace Prize being given to him for nothing, his Cairo speech, his Berlin speech. When you look at his speeches to the United Nations, everyone's fawning. Oh, great. He's not George Bush. He's so handsome. He's so smart. He's swaggering. And of course, nothing pleases a liberal bourgeois American more than to be able to say, I voted for a Negro. it's kind of all that craziness going on. So it kind of goes to his head. You know, nobody was – there was – who was criticizing Barack Obama back then except for crackpots? Everybody loved the guy. So I think, you know, narcissism has a lot to do with it. But what he did focus singularly on, I think he really took a lot of those ridiculous stories that Seymour Hersh used to write about, you know, where there's this sort of secret plan to bomb Iran and all this kind of stuff. I think he took that stuff far too seriously. And that was a really strange period because on the one hand, you know, you had the liberal elites and the Democratic Party spin machine saying, oh, this is crazy. Iran doesn't really present a threat. You know, they don't, there's no real nuclear threat. And on the other hand, you know, they're saying, and the Iranians were saying the same thing. It's like, what are you talking about? You know, of course, haha, we're not trying to build a bomb. But then they were all falling over themselves to do this nuclear deal with Iran on the argument that we don't want to go to a war with Iran to stop them from building a bomb. So it was all crazy. And, I think the press in the United States was irresponsible and slovenly in the way it tried, you know, in the absence of any serious attempt to get at this. And interestingly, you know, the Obama administration has been kind of open about the degree to which they manipulated the press and misrepresented the facts in order to get the Iran deal. And Obama became kind of hostage to the Iranian nuclear deal. Everybody in his administration, by the way, one after the other, on the implications of the Iran deal, particularly when it came to Syria, abandoned Obama. Everyone. You know, you had Frederick Hough, his senior advisor. You had Robert Ford, his ambassador to Syria. You had Leon Panetta. You had Hillary Clinton broke with him on Syria. I mean, he had nobody left except, that creative writing PhD advisor of his. And so the Iranians actually made very clear to him, don't mess with us or you're not going to get your deal. And then you don't do what we don't want you to do in Iraq or Syria, or else we're not going to give you your deal, right? And I think there's a couple of really important junctures. Probably the most important was March 2010, when in Iraq, Nouri al-Maliki was defeated by a really interesting coalition of Shiites and Sunnis, a fellow by the name of Ayad Alawi. He won the election fair and square, but Maliki said, no, I'm not going to give it up. Screw this. I want to keep throwing Sunnis in jail and turning it into a kind of a, you know, strongman state. The Iranians wanted Maliki. Obama, his people said, oh, what the heck? We need an Iranian strongman, you know, or Shia strongman. Give it to Maliki. And that's when everything went south. That's when ISIS emerged. That's when everything collapsed, across about a third of the Syrian landscape. And, you know, in Libya, he was dragged into that. He didn't, you know, it was one... Talk about us like, oh, the American debacle in Libya. Give me a break. I mean, it was the Arab League and the French that wanted to get rid of Gaddafi. The UN resolution said, okay, no fly zone. We're going to prevent him from, you know, slaughtering 500,000 people, which, of course, Assad was allowed to do. And then at the end of it, you know, Obama said, okay, I'll lead from behind. In other words, if it goes well, I'll take credit for it. If it goes south, it's not my fault. And then walked away from Libya, which was the worst possible thing you could do. And then, you know, people, when that red line was crossed, everybody around the world just said, well, you know, we can see why he crossed the red line. You know, he wants his deal with Iran. He's not going to do anything to upset the Ayatollahs. You know, he wanted this reset with Russia. Well, how did that turn out? You know, we kept hearing from the State Department, oh, don't worry about Russia. Syria is going to turn into Russia's Vietnam. Oh, yeah, right. That's what happened, eh? You know, his pivot to Asia totally collapsed. Xi Jinping ran circles around him. There's no Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is what Hillary wanted. more than anyone else before she gave up on it because it was so ridiculous. They've lost the Philippines. Duterte has gone to Beijing and said, I'm no longer in the American orbit. I'm out of here. The second largest standing army in NATO is, of course, Turkey. Turkey is turned into some kind of weird hybrid between the Vladimir Putin's kleptocracy and the Khomeinist theocracy in Iran. You've got thousands and thousands and thousands of journalists who've been either purged or imprisoned, or their newspapers have been closed down. Thousands and thousands of university professors, the same thing. Yeah, just the other day, you know, they passed a law in the Turkish parliament, which would basically turn Erdogan into a new Ottoman caliph. Turkey's gone. Europe is gone, totally destabilized. I mean, this is the legacy of Obama. I'm sorry. And so, you know, a lot of, I think, America's problem is that the left and the Democratic Party elites haven't been able to have an honest conversation with themselves or with their adversaries about just how badly the American enforced world order collapsed under Obama's watch, on Obama's watch. Anyway, that's my little thing. No, I don't think so. Yeah. Paint It Black by the Rolling Stones. That's the music that runs through my head all the time now. Yeah, and you know, I'm this idiot. I'm an idiot. I'm a total optimist, right? I'm finding it extremely difficult, of course, these days to be optimistic about anything. But this might actually bode fairly well for Canada in a strange way. Well, I think we're in fairly capable hands. I mean, if you sort of forget about the honorable member for Zoolander, who's our prime minister at the moment. You know, and I don't want to be mean. I mean, but what, let's be serious, right? I mean, he's got some really good people around him. I think he's got some really good advisors. I think Chrystia Freeland is great. I think, you know, he sensibly took advice and counsel not to get involved in the American argument, not to say mean things about Donald Trump. We have an opportunity, I think, to engage in some necessary sort of self-reflection. You know, Canada's 150 years old, well, 150 years since the BNA Act anyway, this year. We have some very, very daunting and difficult and deep psychological, sociological dysfunctions. I mean, this, I think, the Aboriginal issue is something that gnaws at the cerebral cortex of the Canadian psyche. It's not just a sort of suite of unresolved specific claims and, you know, how does the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People get integrated into various Canadian statutes? That's all very interesting. But Canadians, I think, you know, a sort of sense of belonging and a confident sense of security and place within the landscape is deeply, deeply disoriented by the dysfunctions in the relationship between the Crown in right of Canada and the provinces and First Nations. And I think we're going to have to figure out ways of getting through this and getting past it. Because just sort of feeling bad about ourselves and, you know, okay, fine, Canada's a racist colonial settler state. Ooh, I'm an ally. This isn't good enough, I'm afraid. This doesn't really get us anywhere. You know, we need to figure out a way of understanding ourselves in a way that makes us feel, you know, all of us feel as though we belong and we're family. And we can handle this kind of stuff. We can have all kinds of interesting arguments and debates, but, you know, we're family and this is our country. we, I think, really need to figure out how to do that at this juncture in the history of the industrialized world, because everybody's turning inward. And we can talk about how much we want to be, you know, oh, aren't we great? We're the only country that, you know, likes free trade and likes immigrants and all this kind of neat stuff. But if we're alone in that, it, what does it matter? You know, we're going to get the living stuffing kicked out of us by China, by Trump. You know, Europe looks like it might be going south. We've got two pro-Putin candidates, one being Marine Le Pen, who's some sort of neo-fascist in France. We've got in Poland, it's just Polish democracy is kind of barely hanging on by the skin of its teeth. Eastern Europe is going sideways. You know, the Brits, they don't know what the hell's going on. You get all these little Englanders and even, you know, Jeremy Corbyn, are you kidding me? This guy's like out of a cartoon. So, you know, and we're doing okay. I think this is great. You know, in some ways, you know, when you look at the conservatives in the country have not succumbed to the kind of nativist, jingoist craziness that has so wrecked the Republican Party in America. The New Democratic Party, they're sort of floundering around in the wilderness. You know, they got, you know, Trudeau basically campaigned to the left of them. And but people like Mikhail Mulcair and other people in the New Democratic Party, they have tended to sort of quarantine the ugliness that has, you know, is now ascendant in the British Labour Party, for instance. So, you know, they've got stuff to figure out. So we're in kind of a, you know, to be an optimist, I'd say that Canada, you know, we're in a bit of a good spot. But we really need to stop beating up on ourselves. And the main thing I think we need to do is to be conscious of the degree to which we use American tropes, American terms, American memes, American language to talk about our own political and cultural issues. This is the thing that really disturbs me. You know, you got people who wanted to go to the Women's March in Washington, D.C., and some of them were stopped at the border. And, you know, they sort of went to the CBC and went to the Guardian and complained, oh, we couldn't. The Canada-U.S. boundary is an international border. We're not Americans, for God's sake. Yeah, it's crazy. I know, it's like a cargo cult. You know, it really is pathetic. But you know, and it's not just the right that does it, right? It's it happens on the left and the right. I remember when after Barack Obama was elected, there was a serious move, didn't last very long, within the NDP to change its name to the Democratic Party to sort of, you know, bask in some of Barack Obama's light. I mean, for God's sake, we're a country and we should act. Yeah. Do you know the concept of hyperreality? Gosh, you know, that French philosophy, isn't that ridiculous? Yeah, that's it. I think we're kind of there. We're getting there. I think I'm going to try to write about it this week. It's just so hard to sort of write within the hyperreal of digital media and print media and the sort of traversing the two. I mean, usually, you know, the deeper you get into this stuff, it gets really embarrassing because you get journalists interviewing journalists about journalism. But we have sort of entered an epoch of hyper-reality so that you can actually have people like Kellyanne Conway talking about alternative facts. And the only people who seem to get really bent out of shape about it are journalists. And then the people on the left who make fun of the alternative facts hypothesis that the Trumpists have employed so effectively tend to be people of the left who've basically authored it and created it. You know, there's no such thing as truth. Everything is subjective. You know, the empirical method of is patriarchy or whatever. Yeah, that kind of stuff. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it's so difficult to write about, but I think I'm increasingly kind of interested in attempting it. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, it's just that, you know, I think there comes a point where the toxins of lies spread so deep throughout society. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Right. That, yeah, exactly that. Yeah. I have a buddy of mine, Shannon Rupp. Yeah, I really like Shannon. We argue all the time. I just love her to bits. But she has this notion of fake news as being, you know, like, why is everybody talking about fake news? There's nothing new about fake news. It's always been around and blah, blah. It's just the same blah, blah, blah. Propaganda and lies, and I agree. It's funny, you know, because the basis of our disagreement is actually the word just. People, it would be like saying that, oh, you know, this sort of anti-Zionism that's been going around and is fashionable on the left and everybody's hysterical. It's just anti-Semitism. Well, that's all exactly like. You know, so I agree with her, except that it is this amplification. It's become part of the oxygen that we breathe. It's not just the National Enquirer at the checkout stand, right? Or the Weekly World News. Remember the Weekly World? I love the Weekly World. Remember Ed Anger? Oh, man, that was a great newspaper. It was hilarious. Of language, yeah. Right. Exactly, exactly. Well, that is the challenge. I mean, as you know, I'm quite mental about Orwell myself. I taught a course in Orwell, a lecture course. I'm so crazy about Orwell. My young comrade, Lauren Oates, she's with Canadian Women for Women in Afghanistan. I just love her so much. She and I went to Jura, was it last year? I guess January, December? In the middle of winter, there's the island off in the Hebrides, where Orwell wrote 1984 while he was dying of tuberculosis, coming in and out of consciousness and so on. We traveled all the way to Jura. We made our pilgrimage. And it's really interesting, you know, you'd sort of drive to the end of this road on this remote Hebridean island, and then you have to hike in another 7 miles, I think it is, to this stone deer stalker's cabin where Orwell, he was basically a hippie, you know. He sort of was back to the lander. It was really interesting those years. It was about 5 or 6 people. They had this sort of little commune up there. And I'm a real Orwell anorak. Okay. Okay, good talking to you, man.